Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
Is that different people will get different things from it. What I really want is for it to be enjoyed by people who aren't the kind of people who read wine books. I very deliberately set out, it's not a how-to guide. It isn't the history of a wine region in the conventional sense. There are many people doing those things very, very well, better than I could. This was more about trying to knit in the stories and make it hopefully an entertaining read. And yes, if you want to go and visit some vineyards, you can use it as a guide as well, but it's to tell a story, because I think it's kind of tragic when the stories get left out of wine. It's like me telling you about a novel I loved according to how the grammar was constructed, and not telling you anything about the plot.
Wine is alive, aging and changing, but it's also a triumph over death. These grapes should rot, instead they ferment. What better magic potion could there be to convey us to the past? The beautiful words of Nina Kaplan from her new book, The Wandering Vine, Wine, the Romans and Me, published by Bloomsbury. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. What is wine, and why do people get so snobby about it? Well, on tonight's show, we're going to unpack those questions with British arts, wine and travel journalist Nina Kaplan, whose new book, The Wandering Vine, Wine, the Romans and Me, has just been published by Bloomsbury, where Nina writes, "Every bottle of wine contains the perfume of a particular past. Wine can tell us something of who we are and where we come from." So, what makes for a great vintage?
I'm Nina Kaplan. I'm a journalist, a wine and travel writer, and I have written a book called The Wandering Vine, Wine, the Romans and Me.
Nina, really well done on the book, and you gave a very interesting talk last night in Bantry here at the Literary Festival, and you had a range of slides, and you gave a very interesting tour of the cultural history, I suppose, of wine. And you got some very interesting questions, and lots of different people seem to be quite fanatical about wine. And on that point, I might ask you something. Is the wine world full of crazy people?
The wine world is absolutely full of crazy people. I mean, it's full of passionate people, and I think sometimes it's hard to tell the difference, if there is, in fact, a difference. There are lots of people who get very obsessed with certain aspects of wine. I met a man in Champagne who is obsessed with pulling fossils out of the soil. I don't know how he finds time to make his champagne, because he's so busy doing all the excavation work for the fossils. And that's just one example. My book is littered with crazy people.
And of course, wine means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. Some people find drinking wine a very sensuous experience. Others find it a very kind of intellectual, psycho-spiritual experience. Others, they just want to get pissed and it tastes good. So I'm just wondering, what does it all mean to you?
Oh, that's an interesting question. It means so many things to me, Susan. On the one hand, it needs to taste good. I'd rather drink water than drink bad wine, which is not the same as saying it needs to be expensive. It just needs to be good. But on the other hand, it is, as I say in the book, it is something that I believe can take you back into the past. If I drink wine that either I drank with my father, or that reminds me of something I might have drunk with him, that is a different experience altogether. That is a way of reaching back across a gulf, because my father is dead. He died 15 years ago. And this, for me, is a way of reaching back to him, and also back to the broader past. So there's that element, which is definitely the psycho-spiritual side. But ultimately, sometimes you just want something that tastes nice with your dinner.
And it's a matter of interest. Do you drink both red and white? Because I am very open-minded when it comes to my palate, but it is quite mood-dependent and sometimes time-dependent as well.
And sometimes temperature-dependent. You know, we've had this lovely hot summer, and it drives me slightly mad that people will serve you warm red wine and say, but it's room temperature. And you think, yes, but the room is 27 degrees and I don't want to drink soup in my wine glass. So at that point, I start to move more towards the white and the rosés because at least they'll have chilled it down. Or I ask for a cooler, a bucket, a nice bucket, and I just put up with the sort of rolling eyes I get, which don't bother me.
Is it fair to describe the book as an almost pilgrimage to your father? I know you mentioned in your introductions that, you know, your dad was quite the connoisseur and he introduced you to wine at an early age, and you had this lovely table at home that you used to drink from. And you sprinkle through lovely memories of your family and also of your own rootedness through wine. So I'm just wondering, can you talk me through that?
Well, I think it's wine is not just the bottle on the table. My father was a great raconteur. He liked to give dinner parties. He was a good cook. So what I learned at that table was a whole philosophy of being entertaining, being able to listen, knowing enough to have a good conversation, friendship, understanding, family, warmth, love, all those things that we associate with the better side of life. And to me, they all got distilled into the bottle, if you, in a sense. It's not that you can't have all those things without wine, but we never did. And in a sense, unless it's breakfast time, why would you?
Well, I might ask you about that too. A glass of wine can make a lovely, refresher breakfast.
If I said I had never drunk a glass of wine at breakfast time, I would be lying.
Does it all come down to the Romans, does it?
A lot of it does, more than people realise. There's a lot of talk, if you go to somewhere like Burgundy, for example, about the monks and the need for the Eucharist and how important that was in the monks planting in the best places, tending these vines, these wonderful vines, that we still drink the wine that has come down to us from them. But those vines were already there, because the Romans, when they conquered Gaul, it was Julius Caesar, marched up through Gaul with a whole army, all of them, a lot of them carrying amphorae of wine, because they weren't going to go into battle without something to drink first. And then when some of those soldiers settled there, they planted the vines that reminded them of home. And they got to assuage their homesickness, in a sense, through that way. And so we for the finest wines that traditionally, anyway, we know, we have the Romans to thank. And if you, wherever you look, wherever they went, almost wherever they went, I think we'll probably get to that, they planted vines and they made wine because they believed that civilization and wine were inseparable.
It's interesting, you touch on the fact that, you know, the history of winemaking is also about the history of displacement.
Yes, because as I just described, these vines were picked up from where they came from and moved elsewhere and expected to settle there, and sometimes picked up again and moved somewhere else for a variety of reasons. And of course, this has happened to people too. And one of my revelations that led to me writing this book as someone of Jewish heritage is the Romans took the vine travelling, and the Romans sent the Jews travelling too, with some help from the Jews themselves, it has to be said. There was a big war in the first century AD, which the Romans ultimately won. And so the Jewish people were forced to quit Judea, where they'd been living. And some of them actually ended up as slaves to Italy. And in fact, the Colosseum was probably built by Jewish slaves, insult to injury, using money that was booty from the Roman Jewish wars.
One of the big revelations in the book for me was that there's such a thing as kosher wine. I couldn't believe that. And it's quite a complicated process, isn't it?
Everything to do with kosher is a complicated process. Yes, it's a very complicated process because of the whole obsession with defilement. So it has to be clean and pure. And on some level, that's the practical side of things. So they want to use new oak barrels because to guard against any dirt or anything like that. And on the other hand, it's more about keeping the Gentiles away from that wine. And so once the grapes are in the winery. Gentiles are banned from going anywhere near it. It has to all be made by Jews and supervised by rabbis. I am not and never have been someone who keeps kosher, but I do find it very interesting because it must have been extremely difficult to organize. In fact, it still is extremely difficult to organize.
But it makes it all so more beautiful, doesn't it?
Is it beautiful? I mean, or is it? There's a Hebrew word which is davka, which is about just making life difficult sometimes for the sake of making life difficult. And there's a wonderful anecdote in a book I read where somebody stands up in front of an audience of Jews and says, "You know, we really are an argumentative people." And someone in the audience puts their hands up and says, "I beg to differ." And that's davka. That is davka. And I think there is a certain element of davka to things like the kosher wine, because yes, you want your wine to be clean and you want your wine to be pure, but to go to those kinds of lengths when you are a people who a lot of the time are not able to stay still, are not able to own your own land, are not able to grow up a plant or tend your own vines, it does make life very, very difficult.
When you think of all the pests and diseases out there facing farmers, and you look at the history of wine, it is absolutely astounding to think that wine has survived all through these generations. And I know you do touch on the fact that there's been some terrible blights, if you will, on crops and massive devastation, France particularly. But it is amazing that it has developed and persisted as both a tradition and as a way of life.
Yes, that's true. I mean, the vine is an incredibly resilient plant, which is another thing that I love about it. You know, and again, there are these parallels with something that has been had life made very difficult for it, has survived anyway. I mean, the reason you get vines on slopes is partly because you need the flat land for crops that aren't as resilient, like your wheat and your fruit, your food grows on the flat, the vines get planted on the hills, and what happens, amazingly, is you get better wine from a more difficult environment. Yeah. You really do. If you plant those same vines on the flats, you'll get boring wine.
Are there certain, I suppose, aptitudes, or are there certain skills that really make for a good winemaker? Like, do some people just have the knack, or is it that you have the right conditions, really good soils, some forms of technology and so on? Like, what is it? Like, what makes the perfect bottle of wine?
Well, for starters, I don't believe in such a thing as a perfect bottle of wine. It was one of the reasons I don't like a score system, is wine, like people, is imperfect. And sometimes its imperfections are what you love about it. So, but in terms of what makes a winemaker, I think passion, really. I mean, all the other things are variables. You have people who have been making wine for generations and generations. You have people who have come to this fresh, whose parents, you know, were teetotal, and they said, "No, I want to go and make wine." And obviously, you need some knowledge. I think you need an open mind to some extent as well. You know, the world is changing around us in some slightly unfortunate, more than slightly unfortunate ways. You need to be able to cope with that too. I mean, there are winemakers who are seeing generations of tradition. Yeah. They're going to have to change that because of climate change. Yeah. So I think you need a lot of things, and it's hard to put your finger on one of them apart from to say you have to really, really care about what you're doing. Otherwise, it's like with anything. Otherwise, you'll make terrible wine.
You describe Burgundy as the wine as temperamental and beautiful. That made me laugh so much because it makes me think of the best type of partner. And really, that's what wine is.
Yes, I agree with that completely. And in fact, the reason I spend so much time in Burgundy is because of my partner, his children, my stepchildren are growing up there. And you want temperamental but wonderful, then you know, stepchildren will do it. But it's true that again, it's like the imperfections, the difficulties of a wine, the challenge of finding the right thing to go with the right food, or opening something at its peak. I had this difficulty with the wines that I inherited from my father, where you think, I don't want them to run out. That'll be another goodbye to him. But yet, I know that his spirit, if it exists somewhere, will be furious with me if they turn to vinegar, which eventually all wine does.
So the book journeys from England to France, then through Spain, and then over to from Sicily up as far as Rome. And there's so many different journeys that you make through your own family as well as through the history. We might look at Champagne first of all. Is it overhyped?
Is it overhyped? It has an enormous advertising budget that it uses well, so certainly there is an awful lot of hype, and I would say some of the less good but very prominent names, yes, they're overhyped. Champagne as a whole, no, there are wonderful, wonderful champagnes, and some of them are by big names that you'll have heard of, and some of them are by these little guys, some of whom I mentioned in the book, who would in the past have just sold their grapes to the cooperative or to the big guys like Moët and Chandon, and now have started making their own wines in these very individual and, it must be said, very expensive wines, but they are wonderful, and they have personality in the same way that the winemakers do, which someone making 2 million bottles a year, you know, it doesn't have personality in the same way, even if it's very good.
But irrespective of whether you're loaded or not, could you put down $2,000 on a bottle of champagne? And do you think you could really swallow it beautifully?
No, I couldn't. I mean, and I would like to think, and I will never find out, I would like to think that that would be true even if I had millions. Mm. You know, it's just, a wine is worth what the person drinking it says it is worth. It's a bit like a house, isn't it? When you buy a house, if somebody else wants it, well. Mm. But no, £2,000 on a bottle of wine, which will last you, you hope, an hour and will be a wonderful and hopefully memorable experience. No.
No. Yeah. And the hangovers are just brutal, aren't they?
Well, actually, if you're paying that kind of money for something, the quality should be good enough. You should not get a hangover. I will say that.
Tell me, what's your philosophy of rosé? One of my best friends drinks rosé like it's going out of fashion, and she insists everywhere we go, we've gone into restaurants when the rosé isn't good enough when we move. At a stretch, you will have a glass of white wine, and absolutely no way on earth a glass of red. I can't get my head around that.
Well, I can't get my head around that kind of narrow-mindedness, because think of all the good red wine she's missing out on. But I do love rosé. Yeah. And in fact, I wrote an article in my column for The New Statesman not long ago about the fact that what is this idea that rosé is for women? What is this idea that anything pink is for women? It's so patronizing. Rosé, when it's good, is a fine wine. And all the men whose opinions I respect drink rosé. Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, what's the colour got to do with which gender should be drinking it?
But it wouldn't exactly be your last and final drink, though. It would have to be a red.
Mine, it probably would be a red. The other thing I would say about rosé is there is a lot of bad, very sweet, very ill-made rosé around because people want it. Yeah. I mean, maybe bad is too much of a quality judgment, but hell. Yeah. But so there is a lot of bad rosé around, and there's also a big variation in styles, as there is with white and red. Yeah. But I think people more expect to know what they're getting when they get a rosé, and I think that's a mistake. If you just treat it like a third color, then you'll accept that there are the very pale ones from Provence, there are some quite big feisty dark ones from Spain, for example, but dismissing it out of drinking just that seems a shame, but dismissing it out of hand seems a shame too.
I visited a winery in Argentina, and they were producing rosé, and I was unbelievably disappointed, and I was given 6 glasses of testing and all to various quality and style and blah, blah, blah. I was quite surprised, but I do think that you have to be in the mood. And maybe it's that the weather conditions in Ireland aren't the greatest. The selection of rosé in Ireland isn't the greatest. So people may go into Tesco or Lidl or something, spend 10 or 12 euros. And like, what are you getting for that?
That's funny. When you said you were given 6 glasses, I was imagining you being given 6 glasses of the same wine and saying, by the time I got a 6th glass, I did quite like it.
But I did in the end.
Yeah. I obviously don't know that much about what wines are available in Ireland, but it is down to variation and down to what you can find. I mean, for example, I always used to say, I would always go for those Provençal, those lovely herby, Sanso, Grenache rosés from Provence. Yeah. But some of those now, because a lot of people are saying, oh yeah, if it's pale and it's from Provence, it must be good. Some of them are trying to work that to the extent where they're so pale, they're practically whites,
yeah,
and they no longer have any flavor. So I'd rather have something big and deep red and juicy than something that tastes basically of alcoholic water.
How different are the wines in the Rhone area to Burgundy?
Very different. Different grape varieties, different amounts of sunshine, different attitude, different altitude, different soil types. Very, very different indeed. Yeah. I mean, it's obviously geographically, it's not that far, but enologically, it's a really, really long way.
So on the palate, you're saying it's is it a smoother taste or what?
Well, firstly, there's kind of two Rhones. There's the northern Rhone, which is, if we're talking reds, is Syrah, and then there's the southern Rhone, which is blends. And whereas in Burgundy, what you get, the reds are almost entirely Pinot Noir.
Yeah.
Not entirely. There are a few little things dotted around, but anyway, for the purposes of this discussion, Pinot Noir. And Pinot Noir is, as anyone who's seen the film Sideways knows, is a very particular grape. Syrah is a very, or Shiraz as it sometimes gets called, is a very particular grape, but a very different one. It's much bigger, it's richer, it's spicier.
Yeah.
You're gonna have it with your red, your big red meats. Mm. So, and also Burgundy, while we do get quite hot summers, Burgundy has rain, it has hail, as I think people know, sometimes it has hail at times when you're not supposed to get hail. Whereas the Rhone is just hotter, it's further south.
Do you have to spend a lot of money though to get a decent bottle of Pinot Noir? Like you can get, you know, a relatively okay Merlot for not too expensive, but Pinot Noir is a little different, isn't it?
What I would say is, if you want the Côte d'Or, the most famous Pinot Noir in the world, then yes, probably you do. But there are Pinot Noirs from all over, and Pinot Noir is what's known as an international grape. Mm. So it's planted in a lot of different places, and it's very, very different according to where it's planted. So, for example, when I'm buying Pinot Noir in Burgundy, I'm more likely to go north to Irancy, which is near Chablis, and nobody has ever heard of it, and it's not famous, and the wines are reasonably priced, and they're lovely. And you can get some good Pinot Noirs down in the very south of France as well. You can get some very, very bad Pinot Noirs that are a cheap wine in the south of France. But also, of course, what you've got is Australian Pinot Noir, and New Zealand Pinot Noir, and you know, I could go on and on. So to say, do you have to pay a fortune for Pinot Noir? The answer is categorically no. But if you want the most famous Pinot Noirs in the world, then yes, probably get your wallet out.
It's amazing, though, the snobbery that comes with the wine industry. You know, there's certain people who will only drink French wines or only drink Italian wines. And any of the New World wines, you know, whether it's, you know, Chilean wines, Argentinian wines, or let's say Australia or South Africa, you know, they're kind of going, whoa, you know what I mean? They just rate the European wines. It doesn't make sense.
Well, it's incredibly narrow-minded, and wine should be an adventure and an exploration. But you know, it's like you can go and travel the world, or you can sit at home in your house and go to your local supermarket and never see anything and never do anything. And people who will only drink Bordeaux and Burgundy and the occasional sort of Tuscan wine or Nebbiolo, it's a very high-end version of that. It's funny, you know, I was recently in Australia, and I was in rural Victoria at a place called the Royal Mail Hotel, which is has a very, very fine restaurant, but it really is in the middle of nowhere. But it is also it's a wine growing region called the Grampians, and you, on the one hand, you've got all of Victoria's lovely wines, and on the other hand, you've got all of South Australia's lovely wines. You've got some terrific local wines. The guy who owns the hotel is very, very wealthy. He owns sheep farms. He's a lawyer. I think he's the Chancellor of Melbourne University. He has an incredible cellar, something like 26,000 bottles, and people can come in and buy some of these, and you can take a tour, which I did. When he comes into the hotel, I said, obviously, what does he drink? apparently he always asks for Bordeaux or Burgundy. And he has some amazing Bordeaux and Burgundies because he's been buying them for 40 years. Yeah. He has some wines I would love him to open at a table with me. But it still seems a little bit of a shame when you've also got some lovely, interesting wines on your doorstep yeah. to only say, no, it's the wine's 10,000 miles away and I'm looking yeah. to neither left nor right. Yeah.
It's interesting that you mention rural Australia there and Victoria. I worked on a grape farm 25 years ago in a very small town close to Robinvale. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It was about 100 kilometres from the nearest village lived in a caravan. Very interesting experience. But one of the things that people don't possibly associate when they have a very nice bottle of wine is the hard labour that sometimes can go into it. And whether it's in the grape farms themselves, the grape pickers. You know, we have a history that a lot of the farming and around it, labour laws, there wasn't great regulation.
No, there wasn't great regulation. That is getting better, although in some cases it's getting worse. We'll be interesting to see what happens with English vineyards after Brexit, because most places do rely on people coming in, picking, and then going away again. And that doesn't have to be exploitative, although yeah. obviously it sometimes is. Yeah. But yeah, I think it would be good if people realized yeah. what a difficult job it is to make wine. Wine is not, no matter what some natural winemakers yeah. might say, wine is not natural. Yeah. You don't get it just by sitting around and looking at a watch. It's hard work. Yeah.
And backbreaking when you're on the fields picking or when you're on a factory line and, you know, the crop comes in and it's fresh and they need to deal with it straight away.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, the more, as with food, the more artisanal you are about the way you make your wine, the harder work it is. Because if you're just going to bung it all onto a factory line, that's going to be a lot more straightforward than if you're saying, no, we're going to destem every bunch of grapes and we want to go back and test the wine while it's in the vat all the time to make sure it's exactly what we want and we want to experiment and all of this kind of thing. It's like with anything, you know, your chicken breasts or whatever, factory versus somebody's gone and looked after some chickens on a farm.
You must have loved the research part of the book for Spain. I particularly liked all the history that you gave and the Moors and you went down southern Andalusia. And it's a really interesting history between the Muslims and the Christians and winemaking, isn't it?
Yes, it really is. I mean, there was this wonderful thing called the Convivencia, which was basically the Moors, the Muslims, were in charge, and they had Christian subjects and they had Jewish subjects, but they were very, very tolerant. There was a Jew who became, you know, the senior politician down there, an aide to the Sultan, which, you know, wouldn't have happened really under the Christians. And so there was this period, and it wasn't total, you know, paradise. There were atrocities, there were people killing people and all the rest of it. But the fundamental belief was that we can all live together. If you're not Muslim, you're going to pay more taxes, which means that the Muslims are going to benefit from it. But one of the proofs of this, because there's some debate over how strong the Convivencia was, but one of the proofs of this is the fact that the vineyards survived. Because, of course, if you are Muslim and drinking alcohol is forbidden and you're going to sort of inflict that on everyone, they all would have been pulled up. And I think some of them were, but an awful lot were not. And the understanding that Christians and Jews both need wine for their religious rituals was accepted. And so those vineyards were allowed to survive.
I think you say somewhere in the book about that, you know, we wouldn't have sherry or sherry making without the Muslims or the Muslim influence. Is that right?
Well, the Muslims were the ones who came up with distillation.
Yeah.
So if you're going to put fortified wine into anything, and in sherry you do have a little bit of fortified wine to stop the fermentation process, then arguably the Muslims were responsible for that. So they've certainly, would we still have had sherry? Yeah. Probably, yeah. But they have certainly made sherry the way it is.
And the barrelling process is pretty intricate as well. And you were saying that, you know, whether the sediments that are seeping through, it's carried through generations and generations. So technically, I could be having some sherry today, but it's been barrelled through a tradition or a range of these barrels that have been used for nearly hundreds of years effectively. And so you're kind of carrying that history almost, aren't you?
Yes, I find that so interesting. It's called the Solera system, and it's basically a stack of barrels, and you put your new wine in the top one and it trickles down gradually, and then the next year you take out the blend at some of the blend at the bottom to sell, and you put more new wine into the top. And so, yes, there are probably tiny, tiny residual elements of some very, very old cherries in there.
Thank you.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm talking with British arts, wine and travel journalist Nina Kaplan, whose new book, The Wandering Vine, Wine, the Romans and Me, has just been published by Bloomsbury, where Nina writes, "I am asking wine to help me recover the past." I asked Nina about the Spanish winemaker Miguel Torres and his unique philosophy of wine.
Miguel Torres, I think he's a third generation winemaker in Penedès in northern Spain, just near Barcelona. Although Torres is a very big organization, and if you've ever had Viña Esmeralda, example, that's one of his. But he's a very interesting man, and one of the things that he decided to do was to try and revive some of these very ancient grape varieties, which the occasional small farmer will find a vine in his vineyard and think, that's weird, that doesn't look like the others, but probably won't do anything about it because he hasn't got the resources. And so what Torres did was put an ad in all the local papers to say, look, if you do find that vine, come to me and I'll take it off to the university and we'll test it and we'll find out what it is. And so, and this has been very successful, and they have found several previously forgotten varieties. And you might say, well, what do you need the previously forgotten varieties for? They've got, you know, vineyards full of vines and those work perfectly well. But it is, again, that thing of reaching back into the past and saying, these are, and it's amazing how much people want to do this. That was one of the things I discovered on this trip. People want to believe that they can taste Roman wine, or that they can follow the process that the Romans used to make their wine, or that they can find a vine that is very, very old, and that 500 years ago people would be drinking that variety. So it's a really fantastic thing.
He said something on the lines of that a vine never dies, and it is such a beautiful thought, isn't it? And it's like almost like you think of wildflowers that have been passed through in a patch of land through generations of generations and generations of comfort.
Well, it's also that instinct for survival that every creature, every plant, every human has. And it's a very successful one in that case. I mean, yes, you can have, if you go to Santorini in Greece, you can drink wines from vines that are 200 years old. It's amazing.
Croatian wines I found very disappointing. Adored Lebanese wines. Portuguese wines I'm not too mad on either.
Well, I would say that depends, because Portuguese wines, you've got those, you've got Vinho Verde, which is a sort of quite lightish white. You've got the big red rinds of the Douro, and then you've got, obviously, you've got port. I would say with all of these things, it's like there are bad ones and there are good ones. And if you have a long tradition of winemaking and or a lot of money to spend on experimentation and understanding what you're doing, you're going to get more good ones. Yeah. And if you don't have that, you're going to get more bad ones.
But it's great to see how Spanish wines are so freely available now in Irish or in English supermarkets, and for 12 to 16 euros you can get a magnificent bottle of wine.
Yes, absolutely. You know, Spanish wine, I think, is Spain is one of the most interesting countries for wine at the moment in the world. And it's very interesting because Spain's wine history is, I was talking about this last night, that it became the sort of the mass market plonk for the Romans, particularly after the eruption of Vesuvius in AD 79, where all the best vineyards got covered in ash. Yeah. And the Romans are like, oh dear, we need lots of wine. We have a huge population and a growing population. Spain. And so that's what happened. And you can find amphorae that clearly came from Spain and were filled with Spanish wine all over the lands the Romans conquered.
Do you drink much biodynamic wines?
I do, yes. I'm a big fan. I mean, I think what's very confusing for people is there are three things. There's organic, there's natural, and there's biodynamic. Organic means you don't mess around in the vineyard, so no pesticides, no fiddling around in the vineyards. Natural means you don't mess around in the winery, which is a whole different thing, and biodynamic is a whole process of how you do things, and they do some really strange things. They make up a sort of tea using various herbs and cow dung and things like that, and they strew it on the vineyards, and they bury cow horns in the vineyards filled with some kind of... And I don't claim to understand it totally, but what I do know is you get some really fantastic wines from it.
I always end up having these arguments with my twin sister about percentages of wine, and she likes a lighter wine, not a strong, and I like a 13.5 to 14 or up wine, and just the taste difference for me is something else. But I'm wondering, am I very misguided by all of that?
No, I think the only misguided bit is that the alcohol by itself says anything at all, apart from it's got more alcohol.
Yeah.
I mean, you can get a really I've had a really well integrated wine at 15%. I've had a wine where the alcohol comes jumping out and punching you on the nose at 12%.
Yeah.
It always comes down to, has the wine been well made, rather than 12 as a number on a bottle doesn't tell you anything. Really.
But that's interesting now, because, you know, I will be surrounded by friends who drink 12.5% easygoing, nothing to high impact Italian wines, and they swear by them. And for me, it's just the whole taste on the palate. It's everything. So you would feel, I know anything under 13.5%, I just go, nah. I'm instantly, it's just, I suppose it's just the way we're made up, is it?
Yeah, it is. And as with everything to do with wine, you are entitled to your opinion, your tastes, your taste buds, your palate, and your preferences. And aren't we lucky to have such an enormous choice, rather than to live somewhere where, you know, the wine made down the road is all you've got, and whatever percentage it is, well, tough luck on you if you don't like it. But the one thing I would say is that everything about wine can be complicated, or can be simple. So you can say, I don't want wine that is below 13%, and that's fine. Or you can say, it can be more complicated than that, and some wines at 11% are going to taste more alcoholic, and some wines at 15% are going to... Or you can just say, I like this, the end. And neither of these is wrong. It depends on your personal preference. Do you want to make things complicated, or do you want to make things simple? I like making things quite complicated. That's just me.
What did you make of Palermo in Sicily?
I loved it. And actually, I want to go back, because one of the places that I mention in the book is a place that was a synagogue and then was made into a church, when the Spanish, you know, the newly Christianized Spain, Ferdinand and Isabella threw all the Jews out of all their territories, and Sicily was one of their territories. And they did this in 1492, so the same date that they sent Columbus off to discover America. And so they all left, and the synagogues that were there, because there was a thriving Jewish community, became churches. And they're about to give one back in Palermo. And I just think that's really interesting. Yeah. For the first time in 500 years, there's going to be a synagogue in Palermo.
Yeah.
But the city itself, I mean, what's not to like? Mm. It's got great food. It's got a very sinister, interesting history that goes back thousands of years. It's got beautiful churches.
Yeah.
It's and some mosques as well. It's just gorgeous.
Yeah, you do describe, go into the food in quite a bit of detail in that chapter of the book. And but it has a pace and an energy, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah, it really does. I mean, it had there is still, you know, 20 years after they more or less shut down all the mafia stuff, there is still a sinister energy about it, I find. But it's a very exciting energy, I think.
Tammy, have you done many wine tours?
I've done a lot of wine trips.
Okay.
In terms of wine tours for the public, I have done them. On this trip, in fact, the Bollinger tour I did, it wasn't exactly for the public, because they're not that open to the public, but it was a big group.
Yeah.
So I have done, but what I've done a lot of, and I'm very lucky to be able to do this, is go and be welcomed into a vineyard by the winemaker and shown his vines and talked through the winemaking process and allowed to try the wines. And sometimes given a really nice lunch. And one of the things I will say to anyone who is interested in travel and food and drink is, if you want a good restaurant in the locale, ask a winemaker. That's their customers. They will know where to go and eat. They always do. It's fantastic.
But it's so interesting when you go into either a small wine producer or either the kind of the very palatial estates, the big high value ones, and you walk through where they store all the barrels and you see the whole process. It changes your whole interaction and understanding of wine. It's so intimate. There's the history, the culture. It's a love affair, really, isn't it?
Yes. Well, we're coming back in a sense to what we're talking about at the beginning. It's absolutely a love affair. And these people are passionate, sometimes to the point of obsession, and sometimes beyond. And they usually have strong personalities and a lot to say. And the most interesting ones have more to say than the purely technical stuff of what they picked when and what they did with it afterwards. And some of them are the most wonderful and interesting people I've ever met.
You mentioned last night that Donald Trump has a vineyard. I was blown away by that. I couldn't believe it. But he doesn't drink. Sure, he doesn't.
No, he absolutely doesn't drink. He had a brother who died of alcohol-related diseases, which is probably the only thing for which I have any sympathy for Donald Trump. But he does have a vineyard in California, and all I can say is, never mind the political reasons for not buying his wine, it's terrible wine.
Yeah. But it's a weird thing to actually produce something but not actually taste it, though, all the same. Like, you'd wonder about that.
Well, there's a whole bunch of things you can wonder about with Donald Trump, and I'd say that's the least of them.
But it's interesting, though. When you go on a date or you're meeting people and you're socialising and blah, 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 it is so disappointing when somebody doesn't share a bottle of wine with you. It's a kind of a precursor to everything, really.
I would agree with that. I mean, you know, that whole thing of you don't have to drink to have a good time, it's absolutely true. I would probably qualify that by saying you don't have to drink too much to have a good time, which most of us in our 20s, particularly on the dating front, it was like, you know, this isn't going to happen unless I've had too much to drink. That's just silly. But to meet somebody who will share an interest in wine and will share a good bottle of wine with you and appreciate it, I would say certainly for me, it would be a deal breaker if someone couldn't do that.
You end the book in Rome and you get quite reflective on your own family background and identity. Tell me about that.
Well, my background, as I say, is Jewish, secular Jewish. My parents are both from Australia. And my love of wine came partly from my father's interest in wines from all over. It was he who sort of knitted wine and travel together, I think, in my very young mind. Both my parents, their parents, were all Jews from Russia and Poland who were thrown out of Russia and Poland, either around the time of the Second World War, and a lot of my family died in the Holocaust, or much earlier, so the pogroms at the beginning of the 20th century, my paternal grandfather, his family left then. We were a family. I am first generation English. My parents are first generation Australian. We any further back than three generations, I can't tell you anything. All those records are lost. So that is my background. It's not anchored to a country really. It's anchored to people and to a philosophy of life, and wine very much comes into that philosophy of life.
But you think that we can look at either a social movement or an aspect of history or an aspect of culture, and that in some way we can identify it or find a sense of belonging within our own story? Because it's something that you've quite cleverly done throughout the narrative of the book in terms of how wine has shaped your own personal journey, that of being a daughter for a loving father, the generations within your family, and also within the wider story of displacement, migration, and the movement of people. So wine represents that story as well.
Well, wine certainly comes into it very strongly. And yes, you're right, it does represent it, because the same thing, in a sense, has happened to these vines. They have been moved from one place to another. There are vines, too, that were taken out to Australia in the 19th century and planted in this totally alien soil and expected to grow and produce something worthwhile there, which arguably the same is true of my parents.
So for people out there who feel that, you know, they either can't afford to buy any decent quality wine or that there's nothing available out there that they really want to try, how would you persuade them to maybe move up the grade a little bit and buy a 15 or 20 euro bottle of wine and where should they start?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, I don't know how fixated on price point yeah. one should get. Yeah. I had a conversation with a friend of mine at one point who said, you know, there's no point me learning about wine. You know, my wife doesn't drink, and I'm not going to buy a £60 bottle of wine. He's a wealthy man, but his wife doesn't drink. I'm going to be drinking most of it. I don't want to go above £15. And I said, all the more reason to learn about wine, because actually at £60, you really, really ought to be just getting something that's very good without even trying. But at £10 to £15, there's an enormous breadth of variety. So what I would say to somebody is, there are now a lot of wine bars doing a really good range of wines by the glass. There are places, I don't know where, but probably in Dublin, where there are enomatic machines, which means, and Coravins, which are basically ways of allowing people to open a more expensive bottle and you to buy a small amount of that bottle when it was probably a bottle you couldn't afford to buy the whole of. And that way you can try. I would just say, try as much as you can. Don't get too fixated on price point, but when you find something you think is really nice, take a photo of the label or make a note of it and say, okay, well, I clearly like Pinot Noirs from Northern France, so yeah. let's go and try a few others of those. Yeah. And if you can, go to a vineyard in an area where, apart from anything else, it's always the cheapest place to buy the wine.
Yeah.
So that would be my explore. Yeah, it's a game. Yeah. It's a game. It's not an exam.
You have to have an open mind and a sense of curiosity, and go with it and see where it takes. And you will know what is the wine for you. I've been very pleasantly surprised by some Spanish wines. Nothing too elaborate, nothing too expensive that I particularly like. I don't need to spend €40 on a fancy French wine. I actually really like the 12-euro stuff.
Yeah, I mean, and there are many, many 12-euro bottles that I like too. The only thing I would say is, people who say to me, I don't like red wine, I think you just haven't tried the right ones. I do think that because there is such a, it's like saying I don't like people. You know, there are so many different ones. How can you say unless you've met them all, which you probably haven't? And the same is true of wine.
So lastly, what is the hope with the book? It's clearly a very well thought and well researched book, and a very personal journey you were taking into your recovering your own past. And it's almost an ode to your father, if you will, as well. So I'm just wondering, what do you want the reader to do with it? Because it's clearly a book also that you can go to France and travel to France. Then you can go to Italy, you can go to Spain, and you can be quite knowledgeable all in one day. So what's the hope?
My hope is that different people will get different things from it. What I really want is for it to be enjoyed by people who aren't the kind of people who read wine books. I very deliberately set out, it's not a how-to guide. It isn't the history of a wine region in the conventional sense. There are many people doing those things very, very well, better than I could. This was more about trying to knit in the stories and make it hopefully an entertaining read. And yes, if you want to go and visit some vineyards, you can use it as a guide as well, but it's to tell a story, because I think it's kind of tragic when the stories get left out of wine. It's like me telling you about a novel I loved according to how the grammar was constructed, and not telling you anything about the plot.
And the one thing that does jump off the page with the book is that you humanise wine, if you will. We get the producers, we get the people who love wine, the people who've families have worked through generations, and those that are just unbelievably enthusiastic. It normalises the whole thing.
Yes, well, I humanise wine in every sense, because I sometimes, as you've probably gathered, think of wine as human. But yes, there are wonderful, wonderful people, and most of them, with very few exceptions, most of them are very welcoming. They want to tell you about their wines. They want you to share their love of their wines and of their terroir, their area. And I feel very lucky to have met them.
Dicen que por las noches no más se le iba en puro llorar. Dicen que no comía, nomás se le iba en puro tomar. Juran que el mismo cielo se estremecía al oír su llanto. como sufría por ella, que hasta en su muerte la fue llamando.
And that was British arts, wine and travel journalist Nina Kaplan. The Wandering Vine, Wine, the Romans and Me is published by Bloomsbury and retails for just under €18 in hardback. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Okay, all that's left for me to do now is to say thank you for listening and a big shout out to the lovely Jojo on sound. We've been Talking Books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the words of Nina Kaplan from The Wandering Vine. My last bottle of wine, if I have the choice, will be red burgundy, and it will be good. I am not sure what I will eat with it. That will depend on the season, the location, and my capabilities at the time. I will ingest a trace memory of those long vanquished ancestors in a reversal of the ceremony of the Eucharist, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. And as the first less used part of that Book of Common Prayer quotation has it, earth to earth, you return to the soil from it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. How true. Good night.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.